This lecture, titled Monetary Reform, was delivered at the Ludwig von Mises Institute's Mises Summer University in August of 2001.
As has been my practice, in order to be sure that I say everything I think it necessary to say and also do so within a modest amount of time, I'm going once again to read my remarks. They shouldn't take more than perhaps 15 minutes. And then we can open the floor to general discussion, hopefully centering on the framework I've established, or you may want to go off in a completely different direction. Well, in these 15 minutes, I'll attempt to explain what I conceive to be the essential ultimate goal of monetary reform and why. The essential ultimate goal of monetary reform, I believe, should be the establishment of a 100% reserve gold standard. To be more accurate, really a precious metal standard. Such a gold standard would constitute the best possible guarantee against both inflation and deflation depression. Now, any serious gold standard can serve to prevent inflation, especially if we're taking into account any considerable period of time, such as a decade or more, or certainly a generation. And this is because, as I pointed out in my general lecture on money, in contrast to paper money, which can be increased in quantity virtually without limit and without cost, gold, being rare in nature, can be increased in quantity only within modest limits and at great cost. This is why the increase in the production and supply of gold can be expected typically to be within the limit of the increase in the production and supply of goods in general, with the result that prices would be unlikely to rise and indeed would fall to the extent that the increase in the production and supply of gold were less than the increase in the production and supply of goods and services in general. And of course, along with its many other benefits in connection with preventing inflation, any serious gold standard would operate as a major obstacle in the way of the expansion of government spending, because, as I also pointed out in my general lecture on money, it would compel the government always to turn to the people for its funds, with the result that the people would understand full well that it was they who supported the government and not the government that could support them. Well, in contrast to just any gold standard, even an otherwise pretty good gold standard, a 100% reserve gold standard has the further major benefit of preventing deflation and depression no less than inflation. And that is why I believe it deserves to be the ultimate goal of monetary reform. Now, for any of you who may be insufficiently familiar with the concept of a gold standard, it means that all transferable claims to gold that are payable on demand, notably paper currency and checking deposits, would have to be 100% backed by gold in the possession of the issuer of those claims. For example, if the dollar were defined as 1/20th of an ounce of gold, which incidentally it was for approximately for most of our history, and the supply of outstanding paper currency and checking deposits were $20 billion, then the issuers of the currency and checking deposits would have to have in their possession 1 billion ounces of physical gold, either in the form of gold coin or gold bullion. For at 1/20th of an ounce of gold to the dollar, it would take a billion ounces of gold to equal $20 billion. In other words, all money in the economic system would either have to be gold or be fully backed by gold. Now, this is not the kind of gold standard that we had in the past, prior to 1933, when the gold standard was abandoned in one of the first measures imposed by the New Deal. The gold standard that we had from the enactment of the Constitution down to 1933 was always a fractional reserve gold standard, which means that the gold held by the issuers of paper currency and checking deposits was only a fraction of the physical amount of gold corresponding to the currency and checking deposits they issued. For example, the physical gold backing a money supply of $20 billion, instead of being 1 billion ounces of gold, might have been only 200 million ounces of gold. In that case, the fractional reserve would have been 20%. The fractional reserve gold standard was characterized by short periods of inflation followed by periods of deflation and depression. The inflation occurred when the banks were in a position to expand their note or deposit issues relative to their gold reserves. The expression note issues refers to paper currency. Until the Civil War, private banks created paper currency as well as checking deposits. Deflation and depression set in when concern for maintaining their gold reserves led the banks to stop the expansion of their notes or deposits, at which point a so-called credit crunch would ensue, causing substantial business failures, which in turn precipitated bank failures and a consequent deflation of the money supply. Throughout our history, the fractional reserve banking system was repeatedly plagued by the problem of insolvency. Again and again, almost as soon as its inflationary policy of credit expansion was forced to come to an end by the insufficiency of gold reserves to continue it, there was a credit crunch, substantial business failures, and thus bank failures. And whenever bank failures occurred, the country was thrown into a depression, because, again, as I explained in my lecture on money, the result was a sudden substantial reduction in the quantity of money and volume of spending, and thus in business sales revenues and consumers' incomes. The reduction in spending was intensified by the fact that at such times, the demand for money for holding sharply increased as the result both of the credit crunch and of having been artificially reduced by credit expansion in the preceding boom period. Well, the effect of reduced spending in the face of a level of wage rates and prices inherited from the preceding boom was mass unemployment and a piling up of unsold goods, problems which persisted until wage rates and prices could be driven down to correspond with the reduced quantity of money and volume of spending, at which point economic recovery would occur. In the Depression of 1929, for the first time, the economic system was prevented from recovering because of government intervention, starting under President Hoover, that prevented the necessary fall in wage rates and prices. And indeed, from 1933 on, with the active encouragement of the New Deal, wage rates and prices actually began to rise in the midst of mass unemployment. Now, the association of the gold standard with depression is the main obstacle to its reestablishment. However, as the preceding discussion indicates, the truth is that depressions are not an inherent feature of the gold standard as such, but rather only of the fractional reserve gold standard. A 100% reserve gold standard would totally eliminate the threat of any sudden decrease in the quantity of money and volume of spending. As I've written, once gold money comes into existence, it stays in existence. It's not wiped out by the failure of debtors, as are fiduciary media, i.e. the banknotes and deposits issued in excess of gold reserves. In addition, the factor that leads to the initial sudden increase in the demand for money for holding that marks the onset of a depression would also not exist under a 100% gold reserve standard, and that's because, as I showed in my main lecture, the factor responsible is precisely the preceding inflation of the money supply in the form of credit expansion, which would simply not be possible under a 100% reserve gold standard. A 100% reserve gold standard would be immune from these problems. It would be a system in which the quantity of money would not decrease and the demand for money for holding would not suddenly increase. As a result, it would be a system in which total spending in the economy would virtually never contract. As a result, it would be a system that was deflation-proof as well as inflation-proof. Now, I have to say a few words about the falling prices that would likely result from the fact that under a 100% reserve gold standard, increases in the production and supply of goods would be likely to outstrip increases in the production and supply of gold, and thus increases in the volume of spending in the economic system, at least for prolonged periods. Over the 19th century as a whole, for example, prices actually fell by approximately 50%. Just imagine, in 1900, goods, on average, cost only about half of what they had cost in 1800. We're certainly not used to that kind of thing. Well, such falling prices are usually described as deflation, implying that increases in production, which certainly are capable of causing falling prices, are thereby capable of causing depressions, since the terms deflation and depression are used largely interchangeably as synonyms. Now, I do not think that it's possible to make any greater mistake in economics than that. It's tantamount to believing that increases in production, the source of real physical prosperity, are a cause of poverty by way of causing depressions. And as I've written, the notion that deflation is falling prices and can be caused by increases in production is the old overproduction doctrine. It claims that we are thrown into depressions because we produce too much, that we are impoverished by a process of growing richer, by the process of growing richer. It claims that in depressions, when people cannot afford to buy a home or rent an apartment or even buy food or clothing, the cause of their poverty, of their inability to buy, is that there are too many homes and apartments and too much food and clothing, i.e., that people are poor because they are rich. Well, this doctrine is so bizarre that it belongs with such notions as the sound of one hand clapping. Thinking of falling prices as deflation represents focusing on one isolated similarity between increases in production and depressions, namely the fall in prices, while simultaneously ignoring the radical differences, which are of far greater and decisive importance. In deflation and depression, prices do fall, but because of a reduction in the quantity of money and/or volume of spending, which simultaneously reduces sales revenues and profits in the economic system and increases the difficulty of repaying debts. In sharpest contrast, when prices fall because of increases in production and supply in the face of an unchanged quantity of money and volume of spending, or indeed in the face of an increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending that is less than the increase in production and supply, in that case, there is no reduction whatever in sales revenues and profits, and no greater difficulty whatever in the ability to repay debt. Indeed, to the extent that the quantity of money and volume of spending have increased, there is a positive addition to sales revenues and the average rate of profit, and thus a correspondingly greater ease of repaying debt. Now, table one, which is on the board, and I hope can be seen in the back. I couldn't enlarge this. Can you all see it? Okay. Well, table one is showing that there are two possible sources of falling prices. Over on the left, increases in production and supply, and over on the right, monetary contraction. And by monetary contraction, I mean a reduction in the volume of aggregate spending, which can be caused certainly by a decrease in the quantity of money, and doubly so by the combination of a decrease in the quantity of money and an increase in the demand for money for holding. And in every depression or even recession, there will certainly at least be an increase in the demand for money for holding. Now observe, we have this one commonality. Both of these causes share one common effect, falling prices. But each of them also has other consequences, which are very different from one another. Let's consider three major consequences, which are altogether different on each side. When you have falling prices resulting from increases in production and supply, among the other consequences of increases in production and supply are, one, no wiping out of business profitability, certainly not as a general proposition, since nothing is present to reduce aggregate business sales revenue. Indeed, there's a modest increase in aggregate sales revenue and profit to the extent that the increase in production and supply includes an increase in the production and supply of commodity money, because that will result in a rising aggregate spending and a rise in business sales revenues and consumers' income. Now, in contrast, when the fall in prices is produced by a fall on the side of money, a fall in the quantity of money and the volume of spending, that is what produces a wiping out of business profitability. It cuts sales revenues. There's an immediate decline in sales revenues. One man's expenditure is another man's receipts. If you buy fewer automobiles, refrigerators, clothing, whatever, the sellers of those things are taking in equivalently less money. And a reduction in sales revenues will automatically slash profits, because costs will only fall with a time lag. I mean, just consider depreciation cost. Depreciation cost in business accounting is the reflection of outlays for plant and equipment going back over many years. So the depreciation going on in a particular year will reflect a percentage of the outlays made for all the durable assets in the possession of business firms going back perhaps 40 years or more. And that amount will continue even though sales revenues plunge without any fixed limit. Similarly, cost of goods sold will continue unabated for a while, or only fall with a substantial lag. The cost of goods sold of the current period reflects greater outlays reflects the outlays made months before, sometimes perhaps a year before. So when you have a monetary contraction, the thing that is hit immediately is sales revenues, while the costs continue on for a more or less considerable time, particularly depreciation costs. And that's how profits come to be slashed. Profits are not slashed by a fall in prices caused by more production and supply, not in the economy as a whole, but they are slashed by a contraction of spending. And very closely related to that, because over here there is no reduction in business sales revenues, indeed a possible increase to the extent that there is more money in spending, but just that prices fall because the increase in production and supply is greater than the positive increase in money in spending. Over here, there is no greater difficulty of repaying debt, even though prices fall, but greater ease to the extent that the increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending has created a positive addition to sales revenues and profits. It's only here where there's the monetary contraction that there is a greater difficulty of repaying debt, and that you'll have, as the result, widespread insolvencies and bankruptcies. Finally, yet another major difference is over here where you have falling prices caused by increased production without the monetary element declining, where we have the same money in spending, if not a larger amount. Over here, the consequence of the increase in production and fall in prices is a rise in the real incomes of virtually all members of the economic system who can take advantage of the lower prices with the same aggregate money incomes, or who can take advantage of a lesser decline in prices accompanied by greater aggregate monetary incomes. But over here, where we have a fall in money and spending, here you get mass unemployment until such time as wage rates and prices fall to correspond to the reduced quantity of money and volume of spending for goods and labor. So notice we have one common element, two radically different causes, more production and supply or less money and spending, two radically different things. They do produce one common effect, falling prices. But apart from that, they are radically different. One slashes profits, makes debt repayment more difficult, creates unemployment. The other does none of those things. It adds to profits, or at least leaves them unchanged, but adds to them to the extent there is some increase in money and spending. It makes debt repayment somewhat easier. and certainly does not result in mass unemployment. And to call, to view these two radically different things as the same phenomenon because they have one common element, that is really an incredible error. It's tantamount to calling the good the bad because there's one superficial similarity. That's the magnitude of the error. Now, I want to go in a little bit further. I hope that this table 2 can be read in the back. Can you see it? I can magnify it a little. Does that help at all? Or I can kick it up another notch. Okay. Now, what we have here is I have three entries. Aggregate sales revenue. Now, I'm calling it 1,000 so we don't waste brain capacity in holding unnecessary zeros. You can think of 1,000 units, 1,000 monetary units. If you like, you can consider each monetary unit as being $10 billion or $100 billion. You can make it as many dollars such that when you multiply that number by 1,000, it can add up to today's GDP or an even bigger concept. Now, I'm just assuming that economy-wide aggregate sales revenues are 1,000 units of money, and that would continue if we had an unchanged quantity of money and an unchanged demand for money for holding. And I'm also assuming these are aggregate business sales revenues, the receipts from the sale of consumers' goods, the receipts from the sale of capital goods. Imagine we collected the income statements of every business in the entire economy. We added up their sales revenues, and we added up the costs that appear in their income statements as a deduction from sales revenues, and that's what's represented in aggregate cost. Now, if we subtract the totality of costs from the totality of sales revenues, we have the economy-wide aggregate profit, which we'll take as gross of the payment of interest on loans. We'll take the profit just as the accountants report it and add to it any interest paid on loans by business firms. And let's assume that these amounts remain the same because we have the same quantity of money, the same demand for money for holding. So we've got things the same on the side of money. And now what we're going to consider is changes in production and supply. First, we'll assume that supply is unchanged, supply times 1, so it's no different. And then we'll examine what happens if over some period of time production and supply should double. Well, the general price level can be conceived of as the amount of money spent to buy things divided by the quantity sold. Now, there can be problems in how do we add up the quantity sold, and that could be certain difficulties. But just think in very simple terms. I know I'm going over my 15 minutes because I'm elaborating the tables. Pardon me. Well, think of any simple example. Suppose you wanted to know what was the average price at which a can of soda was sold in the supermarket nearest your home over the last week. What information would you need to calculate the average price at which a can of soda was actually sold? Well, if you knew the total money the supermarket took in exchange for the cans of soda and the number of cans they sold, and you divided the money by the cans, you'd have the average price at which they sold it. And if you did the same thing for the average price of a pair of shoes in the nearest shoe store or anything, you can see the point. Now, however we do it, we do clearly know that the total aggregate output of the American economy today is very substantially greater than it was 50 years ago or 25 years ago. We have no difficulty in knowing that it's much greater than the aggregate output of the Canadian economy or the British economy. Just how much greater, we might have some difficulty in expressing. But I'm just going to make the assumption we can quantify it. And to whatever extent we can quantify it, well, then we have a formula for expressing prices. If we say that the total output of the economy has doubled, while the amount of money spent to buy that doubled output is unchanged, well, then what's happened to the price level? It's obviously had to halve. So here we have a case, production and supply has neatly doubled, the price level has halved. Well, is the aggregate profit in the economy in any way reduced? What will be the aggregate profit? it's still going to be 100. The difference, the same difference between the money sales revenue and the money cost. And the extent to which prices fall, well, there is also, over the same period of time, a halving of unit cost of production. Because how do we calculate the unit cost of the average good? Well, we take the total amount of money expended for the means of producing the supply of goods, and we now divide it by two. So, yes, we have a halving of prices, but we also have a halving of unit cost. We're producing and selling twice as much at half the prices. The prices are halved, the unit costs are halved, and because the quantities are doubled, the aggregate profit is the same. Is there any downward pressure on the average rate of profit? There could certainly be downward pressure on profits in different industries. There could be all kinds of changes in consumer demand. The consumers might decide they don't want to spend as much as they used to on one category of product, more on other categories. Well, then the profits of the industries where the consumers were spending less go down. The profits of the industries where they're spending more go up. But is there any overall impact on the economy-wide average degree of profitability? None at all. And you might have certain problems if we started out, let's say, substantially increasing the supply of some good that people didn't particularly want. Well, that industry would have reductions in profits. But what would the consumers be doing with the money they had been spending in buying from that industry? They'd be spending in buying from the products of other industries. So there'd be greater profitability there. The main point is there is no general negative effect on profitability in the economy resulting from increases in production. And by the same token, there is no general negative effect on the ability to repay debt. Here we are, let's say you're a seller, and now you borrowed money at one point, and now when it's time to repay the loan, prices in the economy are less. And so in order to earn the same amount of money with which to repay your loan, you'll have to sell more goods, right? But won't the average seller have as many more goods as the price level has fallen? If the price level halves because production has doubled, then the average seller should have twice the goods to sell at half the prices. So why is it harder for him to earn a given sum of money? It isn't. Now further, if we allow for the fact that under 100% reserve gold standard, the quantity of money would not, in fact, be unchanged. The volume of spending would not, in fact, be unchanged, because the same broad general process that increases the production and supply of goods will also be accompanied by an increase in the ability to mine metals, if this is broadly based, and there will be an increase in the production of metals, including the precious metals. And even if a country doesn't have mines, even if suppose we have a country that has no precious metal mines, well, what happens to the portion of the world's economy that its economy represents, to whatever extent it grows more rapidly than the rest of the world? It will increase, and it will tend to have a bigger part of the world's gold supply. To whatever extent the gold supply is increasing across the world, if any given country maintains its same relative position, it will have more money. And if its increase in production is outstripping the rest of the world, it will have still more money. So typically, increases in production are going to be accompanied by some increase in the quantity of money. But under a gold standard, probably not, or very often, not as much additional money in spending as additional production and supply. So, notice, now imagine now that over some period of years, over the same period of years that production and supply in general doubled, imagine now that the quantity of money and volume of spending increased by 50%. Well, this would mean that three halves the amount of money exchanged for twice the quantity of goods and services. Now, we have three halves the spending to buy twice the goods and services. The price level would be somewhat less. It would be two-thirds. No, it would be three-fourths, excuse me. Three-halves divided by two is three-fourths. Three-halves the spending to buy twice the output would mean three-fourths the price level. Well, in this case, the repayment of debt would actually be significantly easier, despite the fact that prices had fallen. Because in this case, at the same time that prices were 3/4 as high, the average seller would have twice the quantity of goods to sell, which means that he would be able to earn 3/2 the sales revenues as before with no greater difficulty, with no greater effort than he had to expend before in order to earn his initial amount of sales revenues. So if here we are, you borrow money in some period, in some year, when it has a definite purchasing power, and now let's imagine some part of the money you borrowed is due for repayment 20 years later. And here we are 20 years later, and prices are 25% less than they were when you took the loan out. But at this time, you have twice the goods to sell at the 3/4 the level of prices. Well, how difficult is it for you to earn a dollar to make a debt repayment? If you've got twice the goods to sell at 3/4 the prices, where is it easier for you to earn a dollar? When you had one unit of goods to sell at a price of one, or you have two units of goods to sell at a price of 0.75? Obviously the latter. So here we are, we have falling prices, but debt repayment is not more difficult, it's less difficult. And also, there would be a positive addition to the rate of profit. You know, it's generally known that inflation boosts nominal profits. And of course, I referred to that fact in my lecture. But what you should also realize is that the increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending tends to add positively to the rate of profit, even when prices fall. It's the increase in money and spending that is adding to sales revenues, and costs rise only with a lag. If we have some given percentage rise in sales revenues in the economy, well, the costs reflect whatever the money outlays were in the past, and the spread is going to be widened by the increase in money and spending. Now, this doesn't have to be called inflation, because here we actually have falling prices. And this is one of the reasons I think it turns out that Rothbard's definition of inflation as beginning with an increase in the quantity of money beyond the rate of increase in specie, that is a good definition. The increase in specie money adds positively to the rate of profit, reduces the difficulty of repaying debt, but it may very well be accompanied, is likely to be accompanied, by falling prices. And those falling prices by no means represent anything negative for profitability or the ability to repay debt. So, so much for the very mistaken belief that the gold standard is deflationary. As I've shown, a 100% reserve gold standard would not only not be deflationary, but would be the best possible guarantee against deflation. Well, I think I've explained why I believe that a 100% reserve gold standard should be the ultimate monetary reform. And now the floor is open to questions, discussion on whether or not such a gold standard should in fact be the ultimate goal of monetary reform, and by what possible means such a gold standard might ever actually be achieved. Thank you very much. Mr. Clark.
Thank you, Professor Wiesman. Just on what you stated right there at the end, could you imagine the circumstances that would have to come about where a 100% gold standard could be implemented? Would we need some sort of major banking crisis worldwide, or would we need some political revolution, or can it be done in a peaceful manner?
Well, I think conceivably it could be done. Well, possibly the conditions of a crisis might lead to it. Or I can imagine it being done without a crisis, hopefully without a crisis. But there would be certain substantial difficulties under any circumstances as far as I could see.
And would that have to be implemented with our major trading partners or just...
Okay, that's... Yeah, go ahead, I'm sorry. That's a very, very good question. If, for example, one country, even the United States, which has the largest single economy in the world, If we unilaterally attempted to adopt such a system, we would pull in a very major proportion of the whole world's gold supply, because gold would be very much more valuable in the United States. If you just try to imagine how high the price of gold would have to be to make the physical gold stock equal the present money supply, it would be a huge price. And incidentally, I want to be sure to give credit here. My understanding of how to go about possibly establishing a 100% reserve gold standard, how it might actually be done, is based on a paper that Murray Rothbard wrote back in the 1950s. I imagine he published the essential contents in one or more other places subsequently. But he had the idea of taking the government's gold stock, whatever it might be, setting a price on each ounce great enough to make that price times the gold stock equal the money supply, and then have the government give the gold stock to the banks to put them on a 100% reserve basis and redeem the currency for gold. And that certainly would be a way. But following that way on a one-country basis would pull in a huge proportion of the world's gold reserves into that country. And then you'd have the potential, well, what if some years later, after this country got adjusted, its economy got adjusted to functioning with that huge portion of the world's gold supply, then the rest of the world wanted to adopt the same system. Well, then you'd have a kind of massive deflation even in gold. So it would certainly be much superior to start off with as many countries as possible of any significance in on the system. That would be a very important issue. Yes?
Did you address centralization of the banking system as part of the plan to initiate a gold standard?
Centralization of the banking system?
Decentralizing.
Well, to whatever extent there are banks and they have deposits, and if we were to follow that method, each bank would get gold to the extent of its checking accounts. But, of course, there should be perfect freedom of entry for anyone who wants to establish a bank, certainly a 100% reserve bank.
And secondly, what would you forecast as expectations as far as time preferences of individuals on how would this impact time preferences? Would people save more?
Well, okay. What would be the effect of a pure gold standard on saving and capital accumulation, I think is really your question, and compared with the effect of inflation? And I think that the present arrangement where the government has the unlimited power to create money, that operates to undermine saving and capital accumulation in a variety of ways. I explained one way in my lecture on money, and that was the increase in money and spending boosts nominal profits, but it also raises the replacement price of capital assets. Most of the additional profits are needed to pay the higher replacement prices, but the government taxes those profits as income. So the funds available for replacement may not be sufficient. The worse it gets, the worse the inflation is, the more difficult that problem is. Then, so that obviously undermines capital formation or even the ability to maintain capital. Then the very fact that people begin to wake up to the prospect of the buying power of money continually eroding, I think that reduces saving. And I apologize for repeating myself. Those of you who heard my money panel, I said the same thing. If you're asking someone to save a dollar today that's going to contribute to his retirement, perhaps in 20, 30, or 40 years, well, what can we assume about the buying power of a dollar in 30 or 40 years? It's going to be just less, but how much less? 50% less? 98% less? Anything is possible. And to the extent that people are aware of that kind of prospect, they're motivated to save less. So, and that shows up, I think that's one of the explanations of these incredibly low personal savings rates that have been turned in. And then another element, inflation boosts profits artificially and leads people to think they're richer than they are. And we have a very recent example on a large scale, the stock market bubble. Now think of the people who thought all of a sudden they're rich. How many people went out on that basis and bought things they otherwise wouldn't have bought, expensive consumers' goods? That is promoting luxury consumption that people would not otherwise feel they could afford. That's an artificial impetus to consumption. And then malinvestment. Malinvestment is something that not only wastes the capital that's already accumulated, it undercuts the further accumulation of capital. Just think of the fact that capital goods are physically produced. We have to produce capital goods. And anything that serves to make our ability to produce less efficient, anything that cuts our ability to produce, serves to diminish our ability to produce capital goods no less than consumers' goods. And there are some areas of malinvestment that are perhaps not too often thought of, but deserve to be put under the heading of malinvestment. It's not only the undertaking of unduly time-consuming methods of production, which I'm sure many of you have heard about in other classes here, but think of the fact how many people regard the purchase of a home nowadays as an investment. It's very, very common. Now, that is a byproduct of inflation. You see, if we didn't have inflation, suppose simply that the price of houses tended to be pretty stable, let alone declining. So imagine that if you bought a home in year one, 20 years later, the price of a new home would not be significantly different in 20 years than it is today. Well, what would that imply about the price of a 20-year-old home 20 years from now? If you could buy a brand new home at the same price, roughly, if not less, than you paid for the home in the first year, but now it's 20 years later, what should we expect to be the price of a 20-year-old home? It should be less, because the home is older, it depreciates. Now, in that case, would people regard the purchase of a home as an investment? No, they wouldn't. They'd know that when they bought a home, it was a consumer's good. It wasn't going to lose its value very rapidly, but they would expect that it would lose value, and they wouldn't regard it as a way of accumulating capital. Well, inflation switches homes from the category of consumer's good, where they belong, into a kind of pseudo-capital good. And what is the effect on the extent to which people then buy homes? Well, it'll be greater. There are people who would have bought a more modest home or not have bought a home. There'll be many people induced to buy a home in the belief that not only do they get the benefit of living in it, but it's a good investment. Well, that's a form of malinvestment, and it means there's less capital available for the production of other things. See, we're wasting capital in unnecessary housing, and that reduces our ability to produce other products which are more important. That has to work against capital accumulation. And then there can be, you know, if you had big enough inflation, automobiles could have the same status. I'm sure in Argentina, until fairly recently, you could buy a new car in 1 year, and then when the car was 1 year old, because of the tremendous inflation, it would have a higher selling price as a one-year-old used car than as a brand new car. And if the rate of interest were low enough relative to the rate of depreciation, there could be people buying automobiles as investments. That would be a worse problem. And then you have things like there's uneconomic inventory accumulation. Imagine you have a situation, let's assume prices are going up on an average, it has to be more substantial than today, but let's say 15% a year. And now here's soybeans. You expect they'll go up 15% over the year. And you're going to simply buy soybeans to hold. And their storage cost, let's say the storage cost is equal to 3% of the value. Well, if you had to do this outright as a pure transaction, you'd have to put up 100 and then three more for storage costs, and you'd sell 1 year later for 115. All right. Now, you would have a profit of 12, but how would you stand in real terms if prices are rising 15% in general? You've increased your monetary capital by 12, but prices are going up 15%. you've lost. But now, suppose because of credit expansion, the rate of interest on the loan market is only 10%. Well, now it can certainly pay you to borrow money at 10%, buy the soybeans. The investment as a totality is a loser in real terms, but the borrower can gain because the loss on the investment as a whole plus the gain of the borrower comes at the expense of the lender. So inflation finances wasteful inventory accumulation. That's yet another form of malinvestment. And what good does unnecessary inventory accumulation do to our ability to produce? It's not helping it. It's depriving other areas of capital that could put it to much, much better use. So inflation is undermining capital formation in all these ways. And you could say that either it's operating to raise time preference, or even with a given time preference, it's making a given time preference have less effect than it would. So eliminating inflation would certainly be very, very positive for capital accumulation, and capital accumulation is the foundation for a rising productivity of labor and rising standard of living. Yes, Mr. England.
You mentioned precious metals earlier, and not just gold.
Yeah.
Where would silver play in this?
All right, very good question. I think, and this is something that Rothbard also realized, I don't know the extent to which he wrote about it, however, if you had a 100% reserve gold standard, the value of gold would be very, very high. Now, just imagine for the sake of illustration that you had a 100% reserve gold standard and it entailed a price of gold of $2,000 an ounce in today's purchasing power. Well, if you have ever looked at various gold coins, the smallest gold coin that was minted was a $1 gold coin, which contained 1/20th of an ounce of gold. And that's pretty small. That's smaller than a dime. I don't think you could easily make a coin smaller than that. Well, now, if we had a system of gold and the smallest size gold coin had a buying power equal to about 100 of today's dollars, well, that is too much purchasing power for all kinds of day-to-day transactions. And I think historically, that is why and how silver also came to be used as money. And for many, many centuries, silver had approximately a value of 1/15th that of gold, which would mean that the value of an ounce of silver would be 1/15th of 2,000, roughly. It might not be the same by any means, but 1/15th of 2,000 would be $133 per ounce of silver. And a dime has, I think, 7/10 of an ounce of silver. So a dime would have significant purchasing power. A dime might have a buying power of 10 of today's dollars. And you need a penny that would have a buying power, perhaps a dollar. You know, you hear stories about children buying penny candy in the 19th century or early in the 20th century. Well, a penny at that time had a buying power, perhaps, on the order of a dollar today. So I think a 100% reserve gold standard would imply some very substantial monetary role for silver, too. We'd basically have two monies. You're welcome. Yes, sir. And your name?
I would disagree with that because I think that it's not that important to have two commodities to serve. That it's not a problem of gold having too high the value for serving for small transactions because I'm quite convinced that some sort of my substitute would develop.
Well, it's certainly possible to have money certificates, but notice if you had a 100% reserve, the purchaser of the money certificates, it would cost something to use them. So to the extent people were willing to pay the cost of using 100% backed banknotes, they certainly could, but there would be a cost. and I would think that that would mitigate against their use as media of exchange.
Well, on the other hand, there would be a benefit if, for example, electronic eyeballs come much deeper.
That might make the cost less, but you'd still have a cost. Let's say here you are, you have gold on deposit, and you want the ability to make electronic transfers of gold. And that could certainly be arranged, but whoever does it would have to have the computers and the servers and the terminals and the outlets and whatever, and there's a cost to that, so you'd still have to pay for it. So it might have some scope. I mean, you can't predict what the market, the way it will develop. So there could be room for that. But I would also think if people didn't want to pay those transaction costs, there would be room, a major room, for silver coinage too. And also, I think it's important that people maintain the idea, and this is why Mises was in favor not just of a gold standard, but one with actual circulating gold coins, that people should think of the monetary unit as being a physical commodity, that we not think of the monetary unit as some bodiless abstraction, because that's what is the precondition for the government being able to start increasing the units. Yes, Mr. Clark.
So are you saying that Dr. Reisman, that 100% gold standard is not compatible with, say, digital money?
Oh, you can have digital money, sure, but you can have paper notes too, but there would be a cost. And to the extent that people have to bear the cost, I think the use of actual cash would be encouraged. See, I don't think that, you see, today you can write checks without any charge, and you can write a check for a $2 purchase. You can make a credit card charge, too. And this is because the people providing these services are making money by the investment of the funds. Now, with 100% reserve, they wouldn't have that source to defray the cost of the transactions. The customer would have to pay it. So there would be a much greater use of cash in the economy. By no means exclusively. You're not going to make large transactions by canning out sacks of coins, but day-to-day transactions. And let me point out, incidentally, you know, that sometimes you hear people say, well, we couldn't have gold as money. It's too inconvenient. My pockets would be weighed down. That would not be the problem. The opposite would be the problem, that the smallest gold unit has a very high buying power. Yes, sir. And your name?
Karlstrom,
yes. Robert Mundell, yes.
Do you have any opinion on the chances for returning to the gold standard?
Do I have any opinion on the chances for returning to the gold standard? Well, certainly, if you ask, are we likely to wake up tomorrow or even next year and read that Congress has voted to reestablish the gold standard, I would say no. But why not? Let's put ourselves back, let's say, 10 or 15 years and ask, do you think that in the few years to come, the Soviet Union will collapse? I think that was quite a surprise. So I think it is certainly possible that at some point there could be a gold standard. It's difficult to see how from the present moment, but if some substantial portion of educated public opinion came at some point to desire it, that would be the basis for possibly getting it. Now, I would think it's not very likely that the gold standard will ever leap full-blown into existence overnight, and I think there are various measures that could be taken, partial measures, leading or being conducive to that ultimate outcome. And I think among the important ones, you know, since 1975, it's been legal to make contracts in gold. We have a gold clause. But I don't think there are any significant number of such contracts, and the reason is two major legal problems. One is the threat of prosecution under the usury laws, and the other is the tax treatment of such contracts. Now, to illustrate what I mean, imagine that you would lend someone today 100 ounces of gold when we'll assume the market price is $280 an ounce, and that person would agree to pay you back 105 ounces of gold 1 year from today. Well, what happens if between now and 1 year from now the price of gold should double? So now it's $560 an ounce. It's very, very possible that the courts would interpret that contract as meaning you lent someone $28,000, $280 times 100 ounces of gold, and he is repaying you 105 ounces times $560. And I think that works out to perhaps $59,800 or something like that. And the court would say, this is a usurious interest rate, and it's illegal. So they wouldn't enforce the contract. So it would be very, very important for to have legislation compelling the courts to enforce gold contracts as they're written, not in terms of dollars. And also to make the rise in the paper dollar price of gold exempt from taxation. It would be very helpful if the only thing that you could be taxed on was the 5 ounces of gold interest. That the repayment of the 100-ounce gold principal, that should always be totally tax-exempt. And of course, better still if there's no tax of any kind. And so those would be two essential steps. Going beyond that, it would be extremely helpful if at some point the government could be made to collect some modest portion of its revenue in gold. Like, let's say, the proceeds of the tariff. Imagine that could be phased in over a short period of time. The government would say, starting a year from today or 2 years from today, 20% of the proceeds of the tariff are payable in gold or by check on a 100% reserve gold bank, which could be set up. And they would increase it to the full tariff having to be paid within a short time. Now, that would be a very, very helpful step. That would be extremely positive for the price of gold, as would the making of gold contracts. So those would be important steps. And it would be along the way, there would be room for such measures as perhaps a creditor's protection bill. Right now, everyone who has investments in dollars is threatened with a total wipeout. Well, imagine we had a law which said that some modest percentage of the value of every long-term debt at the option of the creditor, would be payable in gold. Let's say just 5% of the value. So if I lend you $1 million, 50,000 out of that million, 5,000, that would be payable in an amount of gold at the price of gold on the day the contract was made. So if I lend you $1 million today and gold is $500 an ounce, you would be obligated to repay me at my option either the $1 million or 100 ounces of gold. So before I could ever ask for gold, it'd have to be at least a 20-fold rise in gold. But if we ever had very serious inflation, as they've had in Latin America, the price of gold could be expected to rise much more than most prices. So you might have a 7, 8, or 10-fold rise in the real value of gold. So you'd be covered for at least 30, 40% of the contract. The creditors wouldn't be wiped out in their entirety. And that would also be a very educational project explaining why we needed the legislation. And it would be very helpful if, as a good propaganda point, if it were required that every time the government printed paper currency, they had to include on it its value in gold cents the last time the United States had a gold standard. So if today they're running off new $100 bills, they should have to say perhaps that based on the old definition of the dollar at 2067 per ounce, if gold is now $280, well, this $100 bill is really only worth about $14. That would be its gold par value. And we could have, that would be part of a truth in money movement. We, you know, the government wants truth in advertising. Well, we should be out there demanding that the government tell the truth about its progressively worthless money. And it would take agitation of this type for a long time as preparing the ground for an eventual gold standard. So, any further questions? I think maybe we have time for one more. Okay. Okay, Mr. Clark. Yeah.
When confronted by people who don't agree with this 100% gold standard,
yeah.
Can you reference a time and a place that can serve as a template in history where the 100% gold standard was actually somewhat viable or maybe used for some sort of historical reason?
Well, there had been periods. Professor Nataf's lecture, I believe, referred to the existence of 100% reserve banks. But I don't think we can get too far with examples of 100% reserve banks from previous centuries because we are so much more modern and advanced than those eras. So
not in recent history anywhere in the world?
Not to my knowledge.